This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 4, Episode 21. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
0208 816 7691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway. Well, it's another Pitch Vision Academy cricket show, and we're poised like coiled springs, if a coiled spring can really be poised. I don't know if that works or not. But funny enough, I was your name came up earlier today, Gareth. I was having a chat with a friend of the show, Stephen Jones.
Yeah.
Who was in the area for a little meeting with us, and he mentioned that you were a little bit too strong for his team not long ago.
Yeah, he's doing some good work there, though. You know, they had a number of young guys in the team, a number of young players, and in particular, not surprisingly, a number of young seamers. And, yeah, they'll be challenging in 2 or 3 years' time because of the work that Steph's putting in. So whilst it was a bit of a drubbing, you know, we're not a bad side at the moment. I think they're going to come through, and Steph's work will bear fruit in the end, definitely.
You can only learn from that, can't you? I mean, if you lose, you know, they do say take the positives from a loss and all that, which is a bit of a cliche, but it is a learning experience when you lose, isn't it?
And it is, and for a lot of those lads, it probably been one of the best grounds that they'd been to, and there were some definite nerves, as there are with a lot of players that play on the Millfield first team ground the first time they do it. We see it in our own players when they make their debuts as well, because it is an iconic cricket ground. And I thought they did pretty well. Their seamers, I think, 2 years down the line, following a bit more work with Steph, and I think they'll be quite useful. So watch this space.
Well, funny enough, you mentioned nerves and performance and all that side of things, because I had our first rep level game on Sunday, and we unfortunately were defeated, but we kind of defeated ourselves, because we managed to bowl 38 wides in the 40 overs, which after a winter of doing lots and lots of practice at bowling at targets and making sure that we were focusing on the right areas and trying to bowl as straight as possible, it was a little bit unfortunate that there were so many wides bowled so early in the game, which meant that the opposition cantered to a victory. So, I mean, that anyone who says cricket isn't a mental game, that can only be the pressure of performing in at the rep level, can't it?
Oh, definitely. And we see it not just at that level, David, where you've got quite young players playing. You also see it at the top level, don't you, as well? And yeah. I think people get used to it over a period of time, but we're all human, and it does take that period of adaptation. And yeah. I remember coaching Somerset and bringing new players in to televise games. And often it would be their nerves that they'd need to get over in the first sort of few balls or so before they could settle in. And there's a great correlation between wides, as you talk about there, particularly with young cricketers when they do get nervous. And the sooner we can learn to control those things through experience, the better.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also nothing really you can coach, is it? I mean, it's just a matter of playing the game, realising that, you know, you're putting the pressure on yourself. And then being able to deal with that and relax into it a little bit more.
And I think also, because with young players, you know, especially when they start playing under 15 level, you'll find that you might have an under 13 in there, and you might equally have a very experienced under 15 there. Rather than the coach being the one that always gives the feedback and the information and the tips, you'll have a number of players in that room who would have gone through the same sort of thing. So the more we can encourage those conversations for them to relive their experiences, the more experience that the younger guys within the room can derive from that and maybe take on a couple of tips. It's very easy for us as coaches to do all the talking around that age group, but yeah. A lot of time we underestimate how experienced the children are at going through the children's age ranges.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we've got guys who are playing a level up already, and you know, guys who are have already played a lot of cricket, even at the age of 11. So, yeah, it's and I never had that experience at that age. So I guess it just goes to show that sometimes you need to defer your knowledge to somebody else who's actually been there and done it. even if that person is 11 years old.
Well, and they do tend to listen to each other, don't they? You know, and that goes all the way throughout the age groups, from under 11s that you're working with now up into the test arena. A lot of the time, the best lessons actually come from the person sitting next to you, rather than always being from the coach that is often expected to be the oracle about everything. But you know, for yourself, I know you're still a young pup, but under 11 seems a long time ago, whereas the bloke sitting next to you, he might have had 2 years in that age group, and then let's pull on his experience. So I think it's something as coaches that we can always look to do, and it takes a brave coach to do it, but as long as you do it with some skill and some nous, then you get a lot of results out of it.
And speaking of pressure, of course, we had the IPL final, which was a fairly one-sided affair. Did you catch it?
I did. I caught the highlights rather than the whole thing, and you know, I'm pleased that Mumbai have won. Obviously, it's the first time that they've come out on top in the IPL. You know, it's been an IPL that's obviously under a bit of a cloud. But to see the Mumbai Indians, who have been one of the most consistent performers without winning it over the last few years, come through was good. You know, Sachin didn't play in the final, but has called a day on his IPL career, which you know, we need to celebrate. Really, and it was good to see Pollard bat for more than about five balls. You know, and I don't mean that badly against him, but it's always astounded me that sides haven't used him too. I think he faced 32 balls in the final, and that's a reasonable length of innings that a player of his calibre and his strengths can actually positively impact upon a game and dominate a game, rather than being the guy that comes in with the fireworks at the end. So I was pleased to see that happen. Because I think for him, his next stage as a cricketer is to start to dominate games rather than being the fireworks, rather than being the thing that comes at the end of a game. You know, he's a quality guy, and I was pleased to see that as well. And obviously, Dhoni tried to make a fist of it in his usual way, being one of the best pressure cricketers in the world. But particularly pleased to see Pollard come out on top on that one.
It was an interesting tactic. It's one that had worked for Chennai in the past, wasn't it? To hold back your power guy and try and keep the score ticking over and then explode at the end. That's worked for them pretty well, hasn't it? You know, the slightly old fashioned, I suppose, is one way of looking at it. But it's worked for them throughout the tournament. But the wickets that they lost early on meant that they couldn't do that. Do you think they were a little bit inflexible, or was it just? And not have Dhoni come in a bit earlier, or was it just that they lost so many wickets so quickly there wasn't really anything they could have done?
Well, it's an easy one to talk after the event, isn't it? You know, to make those decisions in the heat of a moment is a really difficult thing to do. And having been there, you know, you don't always get that right. And as you say, Dhoni's had a huge amount of success doing that exact thing. But equally, you needed to be sort of within touching distance, in particular with the wickets. And, you know, easy from here, as I say, sitting in Taunton, thousands of miles away. But your best players are your best players. And the same argument for Pollard being given the opportunity to impact positively on the game and come up with a dominant innings. Really, when Dhoni went into bat, they were miles off it, weren't they? And it was only his skill that got them into sort of making the score respectable, rather than being an innings that could have got them back into the game and maybe won them a game. So, yeah, as I say, it's easy from here, but he's a world-class player, isn't he? And I'd like to have seen him dominate that situation a little bit more.
OK, let's wrap up the introduction with our yes-no round. Of course, every week there are three questions and only Gareth and I can answer yes or no, no matter how much more that we want to say. So I've got the questions this week.
Brilliant.
First question. The Champions Trophy is one international tournament too many.
Yes.
Yes. Question two. Throwing youngsters in at the deep end is a good thing.
No.
No. Question three. Momentum is overrated.
No.
Yes. Okay, we're going to delve into the mailbag now. And of course, every week there's a couple of questions that we answer, and the best of those questions wins a prize, which is, of course, an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And it's slightly unusual this week in that one of the question has that has been asked, he has actually said he doesn't want to have a prize. He doesn't want to be entered into the competition this week. So we've already got a winner. But it'd be interesting to see which question you prefer, Steel Garrett. So we're going to go through it as normal, and then I will reveal who didn't want to have the prize. So the first question this week is from Wolf, who is a previous correspondent to the show. And Wolf says, James Anderson, in his response to reporter Alison Mitchell's third question after close of play at Lord's on day two of the first test against New Zealand, having taken his 300th wicket, well done, Jimmy, mentioned finding success in reverting to the original bowling action that he had age 15. And he expressed hope that coaches can learn that you don't actually have to be absolutely textbook to be successful. That's a quote. Knowing how often you discuss this very topic, I wondered how you would describe his bowling action and the changes it has gone through, and how do you rate his achievement?
Oh, good question, Wolf. I'm enjoying that.
You've worked with him, haven't you, Gareth? I mean, you've worked with him.
Yeah, I've had a lot of time with Jim. He's a cracking lad. Absolutely fantastic. And I always remember, actually, the guy who did try to remodel his action, a guy called Troy Cooley, who's one of the best fast bowling coaches in the world, who's also a very, very good friend of his still, would always start a selection meeting within our England setup with, well, Jimmy's the most talented bowler amongst a lot of them. And that was at a time where we had Hoggard and Harmison and Flintoff and Jones as our four-pronged seam attack. So, you know, that was massive praise at the time. Obviously, Jimmy was not getting in the side on a consistent basis with those guys and would often come in when one of them got injured and did a pretty good job without actually hitting the dizzy heights that he has done now. In terms of bowling actions, I've always been of the opinion that natural is best, to be brutally honest with you. And I know that I've learned stuff in recent years that has confirmed that runs true. But I've seen a lot of examples of people being coached in what is considered to be the textbook that Jimmy sort of talked about in his press conference or his interview with Alison. But you know what is textbook, and we see it every day, don't we? Every time you watch any bowling side run up and bowl, if they've got three or four seamers, and there'll be different styles, there'll be some things that sit amongst them that are similar, but there'll be different styles. And I was lucky enough to play only a few games, admittedly, but with a guy called Malcolm Marshall, who sort of rewrote the book, I suppose, you know, having a very fast run up, not really jumping off the ground, bowling with a chest on action and still whipping the ball down at 90 plus mile an hour with massive control. And equally, in the same time that he was bowling, you know, you had somebody like Joel Garner, who was completely different in the way that he went about it, both in physical stature and in the way that his bowling action works. Then you watch somebody like Lilly or Hadley, who would be the conventional side-on action. All of them were operating at the same time, and you could watch games of cricket where all four were playing in. I remember the MCC versus the rest of the world game, where it was the best of the best with all of those guys playing in it, and everybody had a completely different action. So that sort of informed my coaching a long time ago. I mean, as for the Jimmy case, we know now that with the work of these two guys that I mention on a regular basis, that he's somebody who operates with his head outside the line of his hips. And you'll see that both in his, when he lets go of the ball, where his head is sort of pushing out towards gully, and also in his follow-through, where his head goes right down to the ground and outside the line of his body. And we wouldn't consider that to be textbook, you know, if there is such a thing as textbook, but it's very natural to Jimmy. Also, his front foot splays out towards third slip or fourth slip when he's bowling to right-handers. And again, people would say from a biomechanical perspective that wouldn't be efficient. But the bottom line is that's the way that his body has grown with his action over the course of the years. And also, that's the way that his body has developed as a result of the way he walks. So when his foot lands on the outside like that, it works well because his bone rotations are better when they work out than they work in. So as soon as you try and change that and align him in a perfect biomechanical fashion, then he's prone to injury. And that's exactly what happened to him around 2000. before 2005, where he was going through that remodeling stage of his action. And then because he would listen to his body rather than everybody else, he actually reverted back to the thing that had gotten to where he was. And as a result, he's gone on a run which has got him now 307 test wickets at this juncture. So that's my view of Jimmy. That was the journey that he went on, and having been around him during that period of time, I observed that from sort of 20 yards away or 10 yards away, or catching the ball as he was practicing all of his stuff. And I saw him go through that journey of trying to do what everybody was asking him to do, and then come out the other side, reverting back to what his body thought was right. And look at him now.
Well, yeah, you can't argue with the success that he's had. It's an interesting case, I think, because you don't often see a bowler remodel an action for biomechanical reasons and then decide that it's not really working to revert back to what was happening before. So it's an interesting case in that way. And I guess it's almost like it's a case study for bowlers who are working at lower levels to say how much should you adjust somebody's action if it's not absolutely perfect? How much should you work on that, and how much coaching can you do to get somebody from point A to point B, and is that a good idea or not? And there's been an undercurrent of comments, certainly in the media. I mean, obviously I've not been involved in that process directly, but certainly in the media, the comments have been, well, you know, the coaches were wrong to try and even make that change in the first place. I mean, purely from the outside, I would say there's nothing wrong with trying to make a change to see what happens if you think you can make it work for you, because sometimes those changes are going to make improvements on players. Maybe it'll reduce the chance of injury, maybe it'll increase pace, maybe it'll increase accuracy or the ability to swing the ball. So you shouldn't be I don't think you should be afraid of trying to change a bowler's action, as long as you know where your limitations are on how much work you can do with somebody. Gareth, where do you stand on the whole idea of changing someone's action only to find it doesn't work, so oops, we better change it back again?
Well, my starting point for any action change is the guy going to get injured doing what he's doing? And if the answer to that is yes, then I will explore and experiment with that bowler on some other proven ways that people have gone about it in the past and backed up by research, to see if we can find a way of getting that bowling action not to hurt them, because you want somebody to be healthy, don't you? I mean, that's the whole bowling experience. You want people to be healthy and be able to repeat what they're doing without getting injured. Apart from that, unless somebody is horribly underperforming to a pre-existing level where they were going quite well, I wouldn't touch anybody's bowling action. I would probably look at different bits that they've associated with success in the past. We might look to change the approach tactically, or shift the mindset from technical, which bowlers can get wrapped up in the technical, and get it back into actually the bowling savvy stuff, which is what I think David Saker does very, very well for England. You know, very rarely do you hear him talking about bowling actions. He talks about plans. He talks about technical things. He talks about different delivery types rather than the action itself. And so my view is, if somebody's looking like they're going to get injured, or they're complaining of back issues, or they're coming back from injury, then that's the time to look at actions to see if you can prevent that from happening again, or reduce the incidence of that happening again. Otherwise, I'm not a coach that would go down the route of any technical modification, unless that was the case personally. But that's my own philosophy, and I'm sure that there are many out there that would argue against that, but that is my philosophy to fast bowling coaching.
Yeah, it is an interesting one, isn't it? Because you might do something and taking the injury thing out of the equation, because there's not going to be any coach anywhere who says, well, I'm going to coach someone in this way because it's going to make them bowl faster, or it's going to give them more accuracy, but it's also going to increase their chance of injury. I don't think there's going to be any coach who's going to say that. So taking the injury thing out of the equation for the moment, assuming that whatever you do is the priority first is safety. But you think to yourself, well, there is a bowler here who maybe if we do X, Y, and Z, we're going to give him some extra pace here. Or, you know, it's going to help with his getting his body in the right position for keeping the seam upright. So we're going to be getting more swing. where would you stand with something like that? Would you start to consider technical changes in that situation?
Yeah, but just remember that the seam upright bit, which is often associated with the ball being released from over the perpendicular, the reason why the ball's being released beyond the perpendicular is often because of something that is likely to cause injury, i.e. side flexion or a massive leg collapse underneath the body. Well, so again, I would always go back to, is this person likely to be getting injured if they sustain this action over a period of time? And the answer to that is probably going to be yes, to be brutally honest. So then you cut it off at the pass, because we know that side flexion causes back injuries. We know that one of the precursors to side flexion is people's legs collapsing under them, particularly at back leg contact. So we can prevent that. And so when I say, because somebody's getting injured or looks like they're going to get injured as a result of their action, I will shift it. The upshot of that is that their release position is going to be the right side of perpendicular, because they'll be able to hold their body upright throughout their bowling action and withstand the ground forces better throughout their action. So in terms of the seam one and the injury prevention one, to me are the same thing, because of the position that the arm's going to be in as a result of your intervention. The ones that I think are out there, which we're faced with as coaches every day, is when somebody pitches up bowling, you know, slinging the ball like a Malinga, or when somebody throws their front foot out to point like an Andre Nel used to do for South Africa. They're the normal day-to-day things that we see, don't we? Because those guys pitch up at our clubs and our schools all of the time. And as long as they're upright at ball release and they're able to withstand the ground forces, then there's a good chance that they're going to be able to bowl on a sustained period of time without getting injured. Then it becomes a performance thing, and that's where the tactics and the different grips and the learning how to shine a ball, which is a real basic but doesn't get taught properly, come into play. So I go back to your point that you made a minute ago, which, let's take the injury stuff out of it, but often people are always looking towards the performance bit so much that actually they change a bit of an action. The body isn't ready for that change, or the body can't take that change because they haven't walked in that way over the years. And as a result, they get injured. So, you know, I always look at somebody's action and think, are they going to get injured doing this? If the answer is yes, then I'll do something. If the answer is no, then I'll teach them the other bits. The other last bit I want to say on this is that fast bowling is a patient game. And we've often talked about Stephen Finn on this show. You know, at the age of 17, he was bowling at nothing more than about medium pace, but bowling it from a height. And Kevin Shine at the ECB kept saying to people, be patient with this guy, because the pace will come as he physically matures and he gets used to the timings of his bowling action. And now he's got to a stage where he's bowling at a good lick. So it's a patient game. Very rarely will somebody be bowling at their top whack at the age of 19 without injuring themselves. And I think Pat Cummins, the Australian, is a great example of that. Somebody who bowled fast, they pushed him on, they played him in loads of games, they shoved him up the levels too quick, and as a result of the intensity and the training programs, he ends up breaking down. And I hope that they give him enough time to get his body to recover properly and his body to strengthen up properly before they then introduce him to that level of competition again, because we can rush people too much and patience is very, very important. So if you've got a 12-year-old who's got a very natural action, but you know, you think, oh, there's a lot more pace in there, rather than trying to do something to create that pace from nothing, just be patient with them, get the basics in place, make sure they're upright when they're releasing the ball, teach them how to shine a ball properly, teach them how to bowl different deliveries properly, and then when their body catches up with where you want them to be, that's when the pace will start to come up on top of that. You can't generate something out of a kid that's not ready to take on those adaptations. So it's a bit of a rant, but that's the way that I've gone about it, and so far I've had no reason to review and say, right, I need to change it. And all of the research and all of the stuff that's coming out of the various different places around the world is sort of indicate the way that I've gone about that. But be patient is one of the biggest messages I'll have for any coach of young fast bowling talent.
Okay, so the next question is from Alexander, and he says, my question is about chasing down big totals. And he gives a little story about something that went a little bit wrong. He says, my team were playing a game where the feeling was that we were the underdogs. We bowled first and restricted them to a total of 140 from 30 overs. Going into the changing room, I observed the body language was not very encouraging and they already looked defeated. I tried to say a few words of encouragement and reminded them that it was only a few games before that we'd posted 150 in a 20-over match. But I don't think it had the desired effect of installing belief in the players. In such situations, what could someone say or do to get the team believing that this big total can be chased down? How do we avoid losing the match and the mind game before we have even stepped out onto the field? As you can imagine, we went down in the chase quite badly. Thinking about it now, maybe we could have sent an aggressive batsman or a pinch hitter to open the innings and belt the ball around. That may have changed the dynamics and mood of the team. But Gareth, what do you think about this situation?
Well, it's a common one, isn't it? It's one that we're faced all the time. And I've often walked into change rooms and felt exactly the same thing there. The team didn't feel, whether I was playing or whether I was a coach, didn't feel that we were going to get the total. I think the biggest way of going about it is to actually break down what's in front of you. How many partnerships over 60 do you need? You know, what is a big partnership in this match? Because in that context, was it 130 off 30? Was it
140? Like, yeah, 140.
140 off 30. Well, you know, effectively, if you get a 40 partnership and a 30 partnership, then you're halfway there. And if one of those 40 partnerships extends into 60, then the game's over. And that would be the way that I'd break it down. I would chunk it down and I'd keep talking to the players that were going in to bat next and say, right, if you get the opportunity to put on 40, then speak to each other and extend it and get another 10 and almost break it down into really, really manageable chunks. Often we look at a big total or a small total on a challenging wicket and we see threat. But actually, if we start to break that down, then we find it a lot easier. And we had one game at school last year, and it was actually the first game that I had with Millfield. And we were chasing a similar score, 120 actually, in a 20-over game, won a ball. Didn't seem like much. And at 25 for 5, we were way out of it. And I walked along the balcony and asked each batter who was ready to go in how many they had. How many have you got in you today? And one lad said, oh, I've got 20 in me. And another lad said, I've got 15. And another lad said, oh, I think I've got 20 as well in me. And I said, well, that's fantastic, because, you know, that means that we're only a couple of wides, no balls and leg byes off of winning that game of cricket then. And you have to break it down into those chunks. Whereas if people are sitting there thinking, oh, God, we're not even halfway there and we've lost half of our wickets, then obviously, you know, they'll get tense and they'll think that they're defeated. So break it down into chunks. You remember a few weeks ago, I wrote on one of the articles about putting paper cups on the windowsill and knocking them off after every 10 runs. Break things down into chunks and they don't seem so intimidating. So that would be my first bit of advice. Always use your language patterns around what you can do, what is achievable. If we get a partnership of 20, can we extend it to 40? Because if we do that, then it means our next partnership only has to be 10 or so and we're still in the game. So those sort of things I think are really important, within any side, whether you're chasing or not, but particularly when you're chasing, and particularly actually when you're chasing some of those smaller totals like that 140, which seems like a walk in the park. But if people don't believe it because they can't see how they're going to get it, you need to chunk it down to make it believable.
What do you think is the cause of a side collectively thinking, oh well, this is going to be a step too far for us, especially if it's a score where it's within your capacity to get, but yet still there's that feeling somehow that there's that low confidence, maybe the team has bowled out for a low score the week before or something like that. Where do you think that collective shrug of the shoulder comes from?
Well, it comes from belief, doesn't it? And it normally is caused by something. And as you quite rightly say, the week before you got bowled out for For a low score. And I've got in front of me here a scorecard, which is across the road at Taunton, where Somerset are playing against Yorkshire. Yorkshire are racking up a decent first innings total, and Somerset got bowled out for 70 and 108 last week.
Yeah.
So they're in exactly that position. You know, they're going to go out, Yorkshire are going to get whatever they're going to get, but, you know, Somerset are going to go out and there's going to be rumblings inside. They probably won't talk about it in the changing room. They'll probably feel it inside. But it only takes one player to hit two or three cover drives, to flick a couple off of their legs, and all of a sudden, all of that tension can go out of it. So all I'd say at that time is, when there's a collective, we are an individual game, and it will only take one person to instill belief in everybody else. Because if you're all going through the same thing, one person can burst that bubble. And, I'm looking at the Somerset team, which is inexperienced, I'll give it that. But if Marcus Roscoffic goes out there and crashes 50 in the first 12 overs of Somerset's first innings, then all of that tension, all of that lack of confidence will go out the window. Equally, if Alex Barrow, who's played very few games, he's due to come in at number five, does exactly that and takes the opportunity he's been given and ends up getting himself 70. You can break through it. So when it comes down to that team confidence, you know, it's not going to be everybody getting 15 or 20, which will help them to get over their poor confidence before. It takes one person to show everybody else the way and to say, I'm going to break this little bubble that sits around us, which is our lack of confidence bubble. Put a pin in it. Get yourself 50, 60, even 100, and watch everybody else follow suit. And here we are at the stage of the show where David's going to climb up on top of the soapbox and give us his views for 1 minute, one unadulterated minute.
Well, if you've followed Pitch Vision Academy this week, you'll already know that my little bugbear this week is bowling no balls because there are people who have problems with bowling no balls, of course, and that's something that needs work and something you need to work on. But the thing that I don't like about people bowling no balls in practice is there's no reason not to. It's lazy. Nobody thinks that it's a good idea. There's no coaches who say, yeah, no problem, bowl no balls. There's no bowlers who say, oh yeah, I deliberately bowl no balls. It's just pure laziness. It's just people saying, well, I never bowl them in a game, so why should I ever need to think about it in practice? But, you know, successful players, they have attention to detail. And one of the attentions to detail is make sure that no matter what you do, you make sure, whenever you're bowling, you make sure that your foot is always behind the line, because it allows batsmen to practice and bowlers to practice in effective and mindful ways. Okay, so that's the end of the show this week. We have had a couple of excellent questions and some really good discussions. Now, normally, we at this point in the show, we pick a winner of the prize of one of the two questions. So the best one chosen by Gareth wins the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. I already know who the winner is, because one person said they didn't want the prize. But Gareth, which one did you prefer?
Oh, crikey, it's a tough one. It's added pressure this week, isn't it? I think they were both fantastic questions, actually. And the second one really got me off on a rant. About fast bowlers' action. So I quite enjoyed that one. But equally, my passion is for team dynamics and team dynamics around trying to change fortunes or go about changing the way that we go about chasing down totals. So I'm going to go for that second one this week, because it's my real passion. The group dynamic, the team dynamic stuff. So that one wins.
Well, that was Alexander's question, and Alexander is also a regular reader of Pitch Vision Academy, listener to the show, and he is the one who did want to win the prize. So Alex, congratulations.
Oh, brilliant.
You were selected, and Gareth, you can breathe a sigh of relief. Wolf was more, he just more wanted a bit of a chat, I think. Because he specifically said, "Yeah, I'm not really bothered about the prize. I just wanted to know your opinions on Jimmy Anderson." Don't call me Jimmy Anderson, I should say. Hang on a second, I've been distracted by something. Okay, now Gareth, if somebody wanted to send in their questions to the show, win a prize, or just wanted to have a little chat as Wolf did, what would they need to do?
Well, they could give us a call on 0208 816 7691 or drop us a line at coach@pitchvision.com.
Yes, you can. You can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy, posting videos on there every day as well. And you can have a chat with us through the tweeting Twitter, which is at PV Cricket Coach. If you want to listen to the show every week, which hopefully you do, hopefully it's an exciting and interesting discussion for you and you get to learn something new as well as being entertained, then you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, do a search for Pitch Vision Academy, you'll find us in there. And if you use any other kind of aggregator, you can find out all the RSS details using pitchvision.com/academy and clicking on the podcast link. That's all for this week, so until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, coach.